I want to ask a question. How many of you here like the Terminator movies? Seen the Terminator movie? So a little debate as to which is the greatest of the Terminator movies. I'm pretty convinced T2 is the best of them, but others have other opinions. But the original, Lousy Governor, good call. But anyway, the big idea in the Terminator movies is there's just this handful of nobodies that are, you know, kind of the off-scouring of the world where nobody pays attention to him, a kid who's kind of a semi-delinquent and his mother who's scuffling to get by, and they have no power, authority, money, anything. And yet the whole future of the world hangs on them. Small band, little cadre of folks off to the side. There's all the events of the world. There's presidents and congresses and events and UNs and Wall Street and powers, and, you know, nobody writes in the paper about Sarah Connor and John Connor and a couple of their friends and are they going to survive or not. But in fact, at the end of the story, everything hangs on whether they will fulfill their responsibility. The same deal, I don't know, some of you may like the Lord of the Rings stories too. Have you read those, Hobbits and, you know, Middle Earth and all? Same deal. Everything hangs not on the wizards, not on the Council of Elves, not on the great powers of Earth. It's the hobbits. Are the hobbits going to make it? And the whole world hangs on that. And Acts, especially the part we're in now, has sort of that same quality to it. There are three men taking a journey that is frustrating to them. Nobody's paying attention. Rome's not paying attention. Jerusalem's not paying attention. If there were an internet in that day or newspapers, they wouldn't have reported on Paul and Silas and Timothy taking a journey north in Asia Minor, getting doors slammed in their faces. They're nobodies. Nobody cares. And yet, it turns out, in many respects, the future of the world hangs on them. Are they going to be faithful? Will they hear and do what they're called to do? So I think the book of Acts is absolutely fabulous for that kind of reason. It resonates with other things we know are true, that most of the time the big deals, big wheels, most significant, powerful, authoritative people in the world aren't the ones that are making eternal history. People like folks in this room. People like guys that have just started a house in Mountain View together and are going to trust God to make a difference in that neighborhood. And people who are speaking up two or three at a time in hospitals and in places where hurting people are. God uses folks like that. So anyway, that's kind of one of the big ideas of the book of Acts. And that's certainly a big idea of where we are today. So as I understand it, you ended up with verse 8 of chapter 16 last week. Let me read 6 through 8 again. They went, this is the they at this point is three guys. A man named Paul, who was in many ways an odd guy. Looking back in history, we know he was a genius. We know he was brilliant. We know he was a man of enormous courage. But in his own day, most people couldn't figure him out. Even the Christians, most of them, didn't know what to make of Paul because he used to be a persecutor of Christians, right? You remember that story? He used to go out and look for people to kill and jail, and now he's converted, and nobody knows what to do with him. I imagine there are guys and men and women in this room that have some of that same reaction at times. There are a bunch of other Christians that aren't really sure you're one of them yet because you come from some weird place or whatever. Paul had that deal going for him, and Silas is kind of a quiet guy, a little hard else to know about him. And then there's Timothy, who is orphaned by, probably rejected by his dad, left behind by his dad, and he's a young guy, and he's kind of scared. And there's nothing about these people that would make them, you know, they aren't going to make commercials because these guys are so good looking or, you know, are so important out of these guys. They're just, and there's three of them, and they're taking this trip. Here's the trip. They went through the region of Phrygia and Galatia, having been forbidden by the Holy Spirit to speak the word in Asia. And when they came opposite Mysia, they were attempting to go into Bithynia, but the Spirit of Jesus did not allow them. So passing through Mysia, they went down to Troas. Now that's three verses, but it covers 400 miles. And it covers probably weeks and weeks of travel. And these guys are traveling north from where they were, and they are attempting to preach the gospel. And every time they make an attempt, God forbids them. It isn't just that They go into a town and they preach and they get rejected, and they're used to that. That some believe and some don't, and they get run out of town. They've had that happen before, but the Lord is saying, no, you can't go here. The Spirit of Jesus forbade them to go. And so they're taking this trip and heading north, and they think they're doing the right thing. And we know that these regions later will have strong churches in them. There's nothing wrong with going into Bithynia, nothing wrong with it. In fact, later it becomes a region that had very strong churches in it. But somehow or other, they weren't supposed to go there because they were supposed to go somewhere else. That's what they find out. And that's kind of where we'll pick it up today. So finally go down to Troas. That's the ancient city of Troy. Remember Helen of Troy and, you know, all that sort of thing. But anyway, that's the ancient city of Troy. It's on the Mediterranean coast. It's a seaport. And verse 9, here we pick it up. A vision appeared to Paul in the night. A man of Macedonia was standing, appearing to him and saying, come over to Macedonia and help us. When he had seen the vision, immediately we sought to go into Macedonia. Now, it's a pretty interesting thing that happens in verse 10. The guy that's writing this book all of a sudden is on the trip. They did this, they did this, Paul did this, they did this. All of a sudden, in the middle of verse 10, we did this. And for a section of about two chapters, the man who's writing this book, his name's Luke, he's going to be on the trip. He never mentions himself except for this very subtle change in how he's writing. And most scholars think that he's from the city of Philippi, which is the next place they're going, that he was in Troas, he was going to be heading home to Philippi, and God puts him on this journey. So now there are four of them. When he had the vision, immediately we sought to go into Macedonia, concluding that God had called us to preach the gospel to them. So putting out to sea from Troas, we ran a straight course to Samothrace, and on the following day to Neapolis, and from there to Philippi, which is a leading city of the district of Macedonia, a Roman colony, and we were staying in this city for some days. Now, what do you imagine is the mindset of these guys? They've taken this 400-mile trek, trying to serve God, trying to speak up, trying to go into places and do ministry. No, 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 you can't go. Jesus won't let them go. The Spirit forbades them to go, and so on. Now, finally, they have a vision. Paul has a vision from the Lord saying, come over here, a man of Macedonia, beckoning them to come. And it says, the next day we woke up, we ran a straight course. Immediately we jumped on a ship. There's this sort of leaning forward. I kind of picture this little ship journey, sort of like Leonardo DiCaprio. Remember on the front of the Titanic, you know, leaning forward into the waves. And they're so excited. Finally, God is saying yes. After all the time he said no. What do you think it would have been like to be on that trip? Put yourself there, just for the heck of it. Use your imagination. What were they thinking? What were they feeling? What were they expecting? Finally, sure. Thank you, Lord. What else? Anything else? Yeah. Curiosity, excitement, the unknown, it's a worry, sure. I wonder, you know, are we up to it? Maybe that part of that too. What else? Yeah, back there. Yeah. Sure, it's very similar to our Christian walk. We don't know what's going to happen next. We're sure God's in it, and we're going someplace, but we don't know what it's going to be like. And there's the group of four of them, and they're probably talking and praying and holding each other up. And what are we going to find? And, oh, I can't wait to find out what we're going to find. And Marta, you said something. I didn't hear it. What? Anxiety, yeah. Some anxiety, yeah. Strategizing, that's right. Okay, good call. Making a plan, some kind. All right, great. I think everything we're saying is exactly what I would have expected. I'm sure that's what it was like for them. Let me say a couple other things about what is just about to happen now. They are crossing a section of the Mediterranean Sea that is leaving behind the modern country of Turkey, actually. It was called Asia Minor in those days. That was a Roman name. You know, Rome conquered the world. They gave names to all the provinces, and that was the name they gave to this place. And they're sailing into what we now know as Europe, into Greece, basically, northern part of the modern country of Greece. And looking back, people who sort of take world history seriously will say that this is one of the most important boat trips ever taken, because we know from later history that the region that is now Turkey and all the regions to the east and south of that would eventually be controlled by Islam. For most of the 2,000 year, well, Islam, of course, was 600 and after that, but for, you know, centuries after centuries, the region that they are leaving behind, all the early churches that were founded from Jerusalem to, you know, north to Syria and all the other places they'd gone, eventually would become the part of the world that was subject to the rule of Islam for all these centuries. It was Europe, effectively, where Christianity took root and would thrive, and for most of the centuries since then, the places that, you know, sent missionaries to North America and South America and to Asia were essentially from Europe. So in some ways, they are going now to plant the gospel in a part of the world where it would thrive for a very long time, even though the places where they had been would be overrun at some point. This is a big deal. The flag of Christ is about to be planted in a place where it could thrive and survive and the gospel could go forward. And a lot of theorists, by the way, speculate that North America and Europe are in decline now, and that the church for the next century or two is going to, if the Lord doesn't come back, is going to be centered in Asia and Africa. And it may very well be that that's true, that we become the part of the world that, yeah, is post-Christian, and where the gospel, you know, the center of light being shed abroad might well be Asia and Africa. That's all speculation. But the point is, this was, looking back, a very important deal. They're going to a place where it's critical that they go, and where something important is supposed to happen, and they feel like something's going to happen, and there's a vision sending them there. And so anyway, this is very exciting stuff. It says that Philippi was a Roman colony, which means it's sort of like our Washington, D.C. It was a federal district where a great deal of Roman expatriates went to live, and they sort of were very impressed. Everything Roman was, you know, a big deal to them. It was strategic in that way. So, all of us agree, cool stuff's about to happen, important stuff's about to happen, strategic stuff's about to happen, key people are going to be encountered, the Lord is going to take some territory, and then we'll read what happens. So they arrived, they had seen a man beckoning them, come to Macedonia, they're looking for the man, they're looking for the opportunity. Verse 13. And on the Sabbath day, we went outside the gate to a riverside where we were supposing that there would be a place of prayer. And we sat down and began speaking to the women who had assembled. A woman named Lydia from the city of Thyatira, a seller of purple fabrics, a worshiper of God, was listening. And the Lord opened her heart to respond to these things spoken by Paul. And when she was a seller of purple fabrics, a worshiper of God, and was listening. And the Lord opened her heart to respond to the things spoken by Paul. And when she and her household had been baptized, she urged us, saying, "If you have judged me to be faithful to the Lord, come into my house." And she prevailed on us. Now, do you remember earlier when Paul and his companions, whomever they were at the time, went into a city? Where did they go first to start preaching the gospel? I mean, is it in a synagogue, right? Why would that be? Any thoughts on why you would go first? Let's say you go into Antioch of Syria, or you go into some other town along the way. Why would you go first to the synagogue of the Jews if, as a way to sort of break open a city for Christ? Yeah. Amen. Right. Right. Okay? First of all, Paul never could get over his passion to see Jews come to Christ. That's absolutely true. Even though he accepted finally from the Lord, you're called to go to the Gentiles, he still was passionate about the Jews. But there's another reason why I think even if you want to minister to Gentiles, let's say your strategy, or to minister to a whole city, Jews and Gentiles, why would you go to a synagogue first? There's some other reasons why that might be.
Because it was fulfillment of the Old Testament.
Okay.
They went there to say, look, Jesus was the real deal.
Right.
And here are all the examples.
The promises, the examples, all of the kind of the heart, who the Messiah is going to come from the Jews. Absolutely. Ron? Pardon me? Used to be a Pharisee? Absolutely. Lane?
Yeah. As a Christian, the reason I would go to the temple is because that's where Jesus went.
Okay.
I went first to the synagogue. And Christian means Christ-like.
Right. Okay. Here's another thing that's true of the old synagogue system. When the Jews were dispersed all over the Roman Empire, they were under persecution, they had to leave their homeland. They went to Greece, Macedonia, they went to Rome, they went to Italy, they went to Spain, they went to Africa. The Jews were under persecution, forced out of their homeland, and everywhere they went, they would start synagogues. You needed 10 men, by the way, to live in a place. If you had 10 adult men, you could and were supposed to start a synagogue. And here's what happened in the synagogues. Jews would pray, they would read the scriptures, they would encourage one another in the faith, they would train their children. They couldn't offer sacrifices because it wasn't a temple, but they were able to carry out their experience of being believing people, joined together. But they let Gentiles listen in at the window. And in some of the bigger synagogues, they had a place in the back where the Gentiles could come. And who were the Gentiles that would come? These are the ones who were sick to death of idol worship. The ones who longed in their hearts to know a God of compassion, a God who gave good laws to his people, a God who keeps his promises, the Lord of heaven and earth. The seeking Gentile people in any community who were tired of, you know, doing all the vile things that the idols of the ancient world called for them to do, who wished in their heart that God would love them, but they couldn't be included, but they wanted to at least hear the Psalms read. They would be read in Greek, by the way. Synagogues usually carried, they're out there so everybody could hear, understand. O Lord, our Lord, how majestic is your name in all the earth. If you get to hear that read, and your heart's breaking and you're tired of your sin, the Gentile people who had pre-selected themselves to be ready to believe God were already outside the synagogue listening. It's just like our situation. Where are the places? Let's just think about this for a minute. Where are the places in the world, in our world, where people that are sick of the world go? AA, amen. Sure enough. Often. I mean, some people in AA don't want anything to do with God, but some of them do. And it's kind of like it's not working for me. The worship of money is not working for me. The worship of drugs, sex, and rock and roll is not working for me. I wish God could be known. I wish there was a place where people would say something beautiful about the living God. And so any time Paul and Tessa go into a city, they're not only speaking to Jews, they're already speaking to the most likely Gentiles to believe, the ones that are hanging around the synagogue. So it's a great strategy for breaking open a city is you go speak to all those who are believing Jews who want to know the Messiah and those who are hungry Gentiles. Does that make sense? Except for Lane, it makes sense to
most. No. It makes sense to me at all.
Okay.
Where they go, God himself turns them away from that. Jesus went there and was turned away from it. God himself turned Paul away and said, I sent you to the Gentiles.
Right.
Okay? So the Gentiles respond much more eagerly than the Jews, and there's an explosion.
Right. I don't think the modern churches are the equivalent of the ancient synagogues. I'm not sure churches are the places where people who are hungry to know God don't know him would go. I'm not making that analogy. I'm saying back in these days that the people, that they would read the Bible is mostly what they did in these And folks who are saying, I wish it were true, would go and listen. That's, but I'm not saying modern churches are welcoming places like that. I'm not, because
I'm disagreeing. Yeah. Just to disagree, I'm disagreeing because I see a different perspective. I see Jesus being by the established church. It was such a great place to go. Why did they kill the Messiah? Why did they send him out to the, why didn't, towards the end, he went through to the wilderness for the safety of his life? So I don't draw that same parallel, not to be antagonistic.
Fair enough. I was going to make another point, by the way. Let's go on and make another point. We'll see where this goes. The problem is, now that we're in Philippi, there is no synagogue. It doesn't say they went to the synagogue. It says they went out to the river. They went to the river looking for a place of prayer. Now, why wasn't there a synagogue? Because there weren't 10 men that would stand up and start one. There either weren't 10 men, literally, 10 Jewish men that could start a synagogue, or there weren't 10 who were courageous enough to stick their head up and say, yeah, okay, I'll help do this. There's no man mentioned at this prayer meeting. My guess is there might have been a couple, maybe young guys, maybe old guys, who knows, but there's no men. And if there weren't 10 men in a city that could have let you start a synagogue, what you would do as an alternative, it was this kind of established pattern, is you would go to a place where there's water, because there were some prayers that had washings and so on involved with them, and you would sit by the riverside on the Sabbath, and you would pray together. And that's all that's happening here. So, the strategic place, we are called by a vision of God. We have been told no for 400 miles. Now we are excited to go to the place where the world, you know, the doors are going to fly open, and the heads of state are going to come in here, and, you know, the city's going to be revolutionized. And it's a complete loser of a group. That's exactly how it must have felt to them. We're ready for the mayor to fall on his knees and ask to receive Jesus, because now, you know, we're finally going to the place where we ought to go. And what they find is this bunch of nobodies. And there are no men. So how does this story of preaching and Lydia's faith strike you? What questions does it raise for you? This very disappointing experience. The thing that they had expected to find, they didn't find. Their pattern of going to preach the gospel first to the synagogue, can't go there because there isn't one. Lord, what in the world are you doing? You finally open a door and there's nobody here. Great. Who's going to change the world? What if the mayor had opened them with welcome, and the city council and all the richest people in town say, oh, we had, you know, God appointed us. We're going to hear what you have to say. And once we get on board, boy, we're going to really make things happen in this town. Stuff that is based on human authority, that's based on the important people. We've got to win the important people to Christ in order to change the world. Anytime we think that way, we're getting it backwards. It never changes anything. What really changes things is when people who have nothing else but Christ and who are hoping in him and have, and when God uses earthen vessels, not gold vessels, when he uses earthen vessels to contain the treasure, then everything changes. But Paul had a hard time with this. I think that's one of the things that I find really interesting about this story is it says they went to the place where they thought they would find some believers, and some of them were Jews. And the most important among, because that's this place of prayer would have been a Jewish place of prayer, but the most important among them, and the only one named, is a woman named Lydia. Now, what do we know about Lydia? What's interesting about her? I mean, there's some details we're told about her here. She works, well, yeah, do you want to explain that? Why? Yeah. She was a dealer in purple fabric, and purple fabric was rare because it was only a certain kind of, I don't know, clam or something, you got this dye from in order to make purple, good purple fabric. And so it was rare, and kings tended to wear it. And so she's kind of like a buyer for Nordstrom, right? You know, she's dealing with stuff like that. And she runs her own business. Now, how many women in this period of history do you think, by and large, ran their own business? How common a deal was that, would you get?
Very
Not many. Right. It also says she's the head of her own household. That she comes to faith, and they go to stay, and it talks about coming to her house, to her and her household, and so on. Which means, again, rarity of rarities. She's probably a widow or an unmarried woman of some. She doesn't have a husband who is the head of her home. She's the head of her own home. Now, again, it's not because she was a feminist or something. It was just by circumstance. We can imagine she had a husband once maybe and died. We don't know. But at this point in life, she's got to run her own business. She has no man in her life that we know of, and the setting suggests that there weren't any. It says that she urged Paul and the others to come to her house. And finally, it says she prevailed on us or persuaded us, which suggests, I think, at least at the beginning, they didn't want to go there. No, we're not going to your house. We're looking around for another, Motel 6, something. There's got to be a better alternative to us. Because, again, how can you build a ministry on you? You're not from here. You're not a Philippian. You're not a Roman. You're not a Jew. You're not a man. How in the world can you build a ministry on somebody like you? We want something that looks more like what we thought it would be. And this, is, I think, was kind of Lane's point earlier, that they were strategizing. They thought they would know what they would find when they got there, and they didn't find any of it. And it says, finally, she persuaded us, prevailed on us to go. And at the end of chapter 16, it says, Paul, when he left Philippi, he went and greeted the church family who met at Lydia's house. This became the center of ministry in this whole city, this whole region, her house. You say something, Robert?
No.
Yeah, absolutely.
This isn't just a 5-minute little handout of time. Yeah. See you later.
Yep.
Luck.
Yep.
There's a fellowship of the Spirit.
Yep.
Here.
Amen.
Come stay with me.
Yep. I'm all in.
You're my brother.
Yeah, I'm jumping in.
Yeah, I'm in love with you. Come over to my house.
Right. The other thing that's a little subtle in this, it says while Paul was preaching, her heart was opened. And the Spirit, I think it says the Spirit opened her heart. The Lord opened her heart. A woman named Lydia was listening, and the Lord opened her heart to the things spoken by Paul. There's a subtle suggestion here that Paul didn't get to finish his message. That while he was talking, she comes to Christ before he gets to the punchline. And I don't know how many of you have ever been in settings where you're kind of leading the Bible study, and you're kind of building to this crescendo, and you've got this great point you're going to make, and the people all fall down weeping and receive the Lord, and you didn't get to finish your deal. It's not a big point, but I think some of the suggestion in this is, even in Paul's message, it didn't get to turn out the way he thought it would. Cotton picking people receiving the Lord before I even tell them to, before I even add my cool, punchy illustration and joke at the end and call them to stand. She's already opening her. The Lord's already opening her heart. And then she wants us to come live with them. We don't want to live with her. We don't want to do that. Well, I guess we have to. We don't have any other. Anyway, you see, kind of what I'm trying to say is, if you were going to change Philippi, you would never have picked this woman. You would never have picked this strategy. But not even the believers, not even Paul and Luke and Silas and Timothy would have done it. Even the Christian thinkers would not have gone here. Would not have, they had to do it. They were forced to do it. Their arms were twisted. And I think that the point that God is insisting on is, my ways are not your ways. And if real change is going to come, it's going to come by miracle. It's going to come by the people that have only the living God as their authority and nothing else to draw on. And we don't think that way enough. We don't value God at work in the unexpected folks enough, I think. Maybe the folks in this room see it more clearly than a lot of others, frankly. But even us, We don't see it clearly enough, I don't think. Sorry?
That's probably why I have such a different opinion.
You got a lot of good opinions, honestly.
I go to the religious people, the people you think would be open to the touch of God and the leading of God. They're the ones responsive to anything but come into my house and meet with me. Yeah. When I go to the guys, the broken guys at AA and share Christ with them, oh, wow, come over to my house. Let's fellowship.
Cool. Yeah. Very cool. All right, let's take another step, because it sort of gets worse. The same point gets made again, but it's even more striking, I think. Verse 16. So they're beginning to meet in this house. People are coming to the Lord. A church is growing. As I said, at the end of chapter 16, it's the church that meets at Lydia's house. This is going to become the center of... I think it's exactly what's going to happen in our brother's house, right? It's going to become... this home where people start to meet, and Mountain View will be revolutionized, and who knows what very cool stuff's going to happen. But anyway, there's a home, something's going on in it. It becomes a church. The church in Philippi is one of the great churches in the New Testament. It's one of the most generous, one of the most Christ-centered. Some of the New Testament churches were feisty and self-involved, and Paul had to, and others had to correct them and pound on them, and they kept getting it wrong. The church in Philippi is one of the most beautiful churches in the whole New Testament. And it's a joyful place, and it's a Christ-centered place. So anyway, it's starting to build, this Philippian church. And then we get to verse 16. As it happened that we were going to the place of prayer, a slave girl, having a spirit of divination, met us, who was bringing her masters much profit by fortune-telling. Following after Paul and us, she kept crying out, saying, "These men are bondservants of the Most High God who are proclaiming to you the way of salvation." She continued doing this for many days. But Paul was greatly annoyed and turned and said to the spirit, the evil spirit that was in her, "I command you in the name of Jesus Christ to come out of her." And it came out at that very moment. Now, this is going to lead to other problems. Paul and Silas are going to end up beaten and thrown in jail because... they freed this girl of a demon, and she was making money for her masters. And now that she is dispossessed of the demon, she can't make money for him anymore. And these guys are going to take him into court, and they're going to end up thrown in jail. And you'll get to this next week. It's one of the greatest scenes in the whole Bible. Silas and Paul at midnight in jail praising God. It's one of my all-time favorites. That's what is about to happen. But let's look at how they got there. What's interesting to you, the story about this slave girl? How do you picture her? If you draw a picture of her, what would she look like in today's setting? The Exorcist, okay. I don't know if she was making money for anybody. I mean, she was just, but.
My question is, what is a divinator?
Fortune teller, basically. She had a demon. Psychic. A demon. So she was really, it wasn't just she was making this up and tricking people. She was really able to say things. Because there was demonic power that allowed her to do stuff that had evil authority behind it. And so she's a young girl. She's probably 12, 14 years old. And these guys are making money off her. Some kind of fortune telling, though, is the idea. Yeah, back there. Yeah. That's right. Right. You bet. Good word. So this demon is crying out from this girl, and he's telling the truth.
Yeah.
That's the problem. Now, think about that for a minute. If you were the devil and you were trying to destroy this new thing that's happening in Philippi, and you have access to a voice, you have this girl's voice to speak from, what would you say? Would you say, "Don't listen to those guys. They're lying." Or if everybody knows it's a demon that's speaking, and the demon says, listen to those guys, then all the good people are going to say, wait a minute, I'm going to go the other direction. It's sort of like being, if you've got someone you don't trust saying, do this, then you're going to do the opposite. And I think something like that is happening here, is that they are being, if people associate them with the devil, oh, it must be that this evil spirit and they are on the same side, then eventually their message and their is being discredited. So it's actually fairly strategic, I think. And and in any case, they decide they need to for her to stop speaking. But is it because they love her? Moved with compassion for this poor girl who's been demonized. By the way, I think the best way to think about her is like a crack addicted prostitute. She's got something that, and men are taking advantage of her. So this 14-year-old girl's addicted to crack. She's got users that'll keep giving her drugs to destroy her, but they can use her to make money in any case. I mean, it's something like that. Some terrible, awful. I mean, to be possessed by a spirit is to be in the darkest hole you can be in. Self-hatred and everything that goes with it. And these guys are making money off it. And it doesn't ever say that Paul, again, was moved. He was just irritated. He just finally got tired of it. And he acted on her behalf only then. Which, again, I think is one of the things that this text is making is that the Christian leadership, that even the apostles, they didn't see all the opportunities. That God had to make them do the best thing even when they weren't quite ready to do it. Because the Lord was even wiser than the Christian leadership in a lot of ways. But once she is freed from the demon, what takes place is a series of events that will lead to more beautiful conversions. The jailer, the rest of the city, the protection of the church. A score of great things happens that comes out of this. But I guess the simple point I want to make, I guess I need to end right now. What time? Okay. Is that for a second time, the key figure in this city is the wrong person. Lydia was the wrong person. The slave girl was the wrong person. You would not build a church on the stories of expatriate women running their own business in a town like this, a time like this, and you would certainly not say the key person in town, the next key person in town is this crack whore that's going to be saved from her darkness. Well, that's the way God will change the world. He'll pick people like that. Jerry. Right. Right. She probably had very little control over her own choices at this point. He had to banish the spirit before he could talk to her, would be my feeling on this. Yeah, Carol? I think absolutely there was.
So, I mean, people would know there would be a strange thought.
But if you want your fortune told, and you don't care, and it's, you know, it's her tragedy, not yours, and if you can pay $50 and find out who's going to win at the track this afternoon, or what, you know, I don't know what you're interested in knowing, but you're trying to find out something, and you don't care about her. I mean, Robert? That's right.
But the spirit already knew who he was.
Right.
And, you know, it's like he couldn't lie to him. He said, what will you have with me?
Mm-hmm.
Jesus, Son of the Most High.
Right.
Same with her. She
right.
knew what these guys were about, so she had to speak.
That's right.
It's like truth and lie can't dwell
That's
in
right.
the same place.
That's right.
So what was the greater power there was truth.
Right.
So she had to speak.
So I think the demons, when confronted with Christ, they bow before his authority.
Right.
But the reason this was a problem for Paul is he didn't want to be associated with the demonic voice speaking the truth, because it would confuse people, I think. That'd be my take anyway. Yeah, again, back.
So in actuality, what you're actually saying is that the demon was trying to use reverse psychology.
Yep.
Okay. And so that he could make his point. And then they would fall away from that instead of when he was going.
I think that's at least a good part of the explanation, that that's the reason why. Yeah, reverse psychology, exactly right, I think. Good point. Yes, sir, back there in the black shirt.
Looking back over the paragraph and what you were teaching, I surmise that when they got in the boat, when they got where they were supposed to go, that even though they were apostles of God's Spirit, they thought we're very special people, we carry the word, and their own vainness got in the way because, as you put it, when you're up on the pulpit and I'm a special person and you take away my last word, okay, then that is what he did. He was very perturbed. And he wants the spotlight because he's a, quote, a very special person in the Lord's light. And then you take his human side and they're, hey, you know, don't take it away from me. I'm the focus here.
Yeah.
Okay, I'm the one with the message.
Yeah. I think there's very clear, it's very clear in this story, and Luke wrote the story, remember, the guy who's on the trip now wrote the story, and he's basically saying, we acted immaturely. They had to learn the lesson. The point is, almost anybody who's in any kind of leadership, you have to make a fool of yourself a few times along the way to figure stuff out. There's no other way to do it. And I think they were learning a lesson. They thought they knew. Well, we've done this before. We've gone to other cities. We've seen it work. We know the strategy. We know where to start. We know who to. They had seen it work, and they were making assumptions that were not valid. And Luke is at least good enough to write the story to kind of embarrass them, I think. I mean, usually when you're on the trip, you write it up in such a way that you kind of hide that stuff, and he doesn't. And but I'm not sure they were cocky or arrogant. They were just, they hadn't learned some stuff yet. They were making assumptions because they hadn't seen it before, and God's teaching them, and that's always true, by the way. You know, anybody in whatever stage of life you're in, there are people that are going to look up to you, probably. I mean, you're further along than somebody, and the new Christian will look at you and say, gosh, you've known the Lord 2 weeks. You must really be cool or something. And I think to realize that, yeah, I have something to offer, but I don't know everything yet. That's a real important part of leadership, is the humility to say, I'm not sure what God's going to do this time. And the preference that God has for the outsider. It's kind of like the Terminator, right? Who's going to save the world? Not going to be the guy that's in charge of the UN. It's going to be the delinquent kid that, you know, that kind of, it's that sort of way God works.